this week. We talked to the author of a four-part series of books. In it, a fictional character, Brother Deacon, a larger-than-life Freemason, extols lessons in Masonic philosophy through stories, considered by many to be the contemporary version of the old Claudia Tyler talks. We'll talk with Brother Chris Williams, why he wrote the books, what they mean to him, and some personal stories that are sure to get you right in the feels. Then we'll have a quick contemplative session on the idea of independence, alone time, collaborations. What's it all mean? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 547. I want to thank the supporters of the program, our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners. Without you, we cannot continue to make this program that we've done since July of 2011. To date, you heard that correctly. This is episode number 547. That means there are 546 other episodes that we've created just for you, which are available all the time. There's no exclusive backlog of episodes that's available to only certain people or anything like that. It's available, all of the episodes, freely for anybody who is interested. And it's all thanks to our supporters. If you're curious and want to help out the WCY podcast, please check out our website, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. We also have a limited edition shop with several different items that you can get. All the money goes right back into the program, as well as we have a bookstore that is all the books that we have talked about and things which come straight from Amazon, and there's an affiliate. So it doesn't cost you anything, but you get the books, our authors get a good sale, and a few pennies comes back to help this program. Now, as you heard in the opener, we've got a great interview with Brother Chris Williams. Let's get right into it. All right, everybody, we're back this week. Lucky enough to have on a special guest. You may have heard of him, Brother James Christie Williams IV. He's an author. Everybody knows him as Chris Williams, and he hails from Texas. And Chris, I just want to say thanks for coming on the program tonight.
Hey, I sure appreciate you having me. This is a real honor. Thank you.
For anybody who doesn't know, Brother Chris, or James, if you find him on Amazon, Brother Chris publishes some unique books. And the books, before we get into what they are, he's got a four-book series out. And, of course, we'll link all those and everything for you guys to check out. But it is a very interesting kind of contemporary look at Masonry, story format kind of thing, and it's really unique. But before we get into it, I would love for Brother Chris, if you want to go ahead and let us know a little bit about your Masonic background, what got you into Masonry, where you joined, and where you're serving today.
Well, thank you, Brother Robert. My Masonic journey is kind of a little the same and a little different than a lot of others. I came into Masonry in about 1985 because my grandfather was a Mason, and it's kind of a crazy deal. He died when I was 6 years old, and he made my mother promise to make sure that I became a Mason someday, and gave me some paraphernalia, a really nice sword and some books, and I just kind of put them in the back of the closet and never thought about them. And 35 years later, I met a man who was a Mason, and one thing led to another, and I petitioned to Davy Crockett Lodge, number 1225 in San Antonio, Texas. And a few years later, seven years later, I became master in 2008, and had an absolutely wonderful year, and that's where the John Deacon books came from. Today, I'm majorly involved in Scottish Rite, Education Committee Chairman of the reunion programs. I run the reunions, and I spent 10 years on the Grand Lodge of Texas Masonic Education and Service Committee. And of course, I belong, just like you and everybody else, to a whole bunch of organizations within Masonry that I probably shouldn't belong to, because there's only enough time in one day, or in one day and one week to participate. But it's been a wonderful experience, as any brother who's listening to this probably can agree.
Very much sounds similar to what I went through myself. And so, yeah, very cool. Thank you again for giving us a little background. Now, you alluded to it there in your little bit of intro, John Deacon. So you've got this series of books called Big John Deacon Freemason Extraordinaire, and it's a series of four books. When I first looked them up on Amazon, I really enjoyed like the cover art, and it was really kind of pulls you in. And this series is like about this big, tall Texan Freemason. You know, he's a past master. He's like the kind of, I don't know what you want to call him, all-American guy, you know, super nice. And the way you've brought this character to life is pretty unique. And what you're teaching, because you, in essence, you are teaching Masonic lessons through these stories, is not, I don't want to say it's never been done before, but it's probably not been done in a very, we'll say, consumable way since probably the days of Carl Clotti. Before we dive into the book a little bit, tell us about why you decided to write these books.
Well, you know, coming up in the lodge, my interest is knowledge and education, and wanted to learn more about the why and where everything came from and the deeper levels of masonry. It's hard for me to learn to hear from masons saying, oh, there's like seven layers of deeper layers of meaning in most everything we do in our ritual. And that intrigued me. And I wanted that. I wanted to be part of that. But unfortunately, lodges for many different reasons can't or don't teach those things. And I wanted to stimulate interest in something more than a ritual. Our lodge has always been known as a premier lodge for teaching the rituals, performing the ritual, and it's always had a great reputation in that respect. But beyond that, there was really not much. So I made a commitment to start a Masonic education program in my lodge, and we have two meetings a month, and I wanted a Masonic education presentation given at every meeting. And so I started that. And one other thing that I started, because as you know, we only get, you know, somewhere around 10 to 15% of our membership that actually attends meetings, I wanted to start a newsletter and communicate with all of the members of our lodge. I wanted the focus to be Masonic education. And so I did that. And like I was saying before, the first 3 months of the newsletter, the Masonic education were topics and articles that I made were great. I loved them. And the guys that actually read them loved them. But for the most part, guys were clicking on the newsletter and looking, oh God, Masonic education, and going to the pictures. They weren't actually reading the articles. So I literally created a brother named John Deacon and gave him a life and started writing articles about him and I's monthly dinners or lunches together and what happened. And the thing that made it interesting is it was humorous. Something crazy always happened, and he would always cause some kind of altercation with, you know, something always happened that was crazy or funny or mostly funny, and he'd come out as the hero, and we woven in between it was some kind of a Masonic lesson. And moral lesson that I wanted to portray. And it just kind of took off and got super popular around here. And before long, our newsletter was being sent out and shared by over 2,500 people and some of them around the world. So it just kind of blossomed. And we never expected it. I never expected it. I just simply wanted to get Masonic education out to all the guys.
I love it. I love this idea that, you know, it's so homegrown and it's kind of a unique idea. And one of the reasons why we see, I think, Masonic education struggle, I mean, we've seen, we've talked about this kind of stuff ad nauseum, but there is a really big disconnect in the types of education that people are getting. And I think the common ground is what I would call a Masonic philosophy in everyday living, like practical Masonic philosophy. And there's not a lot of people that are going after that. I mean, you know, I'm somebody who's a very spiritual, esoteric, kind of driven Mason, but I've never lost sight of the Clotti books. I've never lost sight of sitting around the table with my brothers and listening to the stories and laughing and learning something really interesting about, you know, what they've given us. And I think if you can take that and bottle it up, you've got probably something very similar to what you've presented here. Can I ask, Big John Deacon, the Freemason extraordinaire, is he inspired by one or more individuals that you've kind of put together, or is this a holy creation on your own?
You know, that question has been asked me so many times, and I have to tell you that, number one, the personality of Big John Deacon revolves a lot as far as his persona and his attitude and his personality revolves around the kind of guy that was portrayed by Dan Blocker in the old series Bonanza. You know, he was just a big guy with a sweet attitude, and it took a lot to make him angry and all of that. And that may seem a little foreign to a lot of the younger viewers, but I hope they will look it up and maybe see who he was. But the actual material that he and I talked about and the situations that I put him in and situations that were part of the book, way in the back of my mind had to be Brother Carl Claudy, because I loved his books and I loved what he did. But these situations that John and I went through every month, he always kind of portrayed a different person in my mind or in my life. And he was basically, number one, you know, he was my dad, and he was me, and he was a little bit of every Masonic brother I've ever been in contact with. He brought out, I mean, I would have guys call me up and say, "Hey, that John was me this month, wasn't he?" And I'd say, "Well, yeah, kind of, you know," and they'd come up with the situation that the story that I told, and it was just, you know, I just wanted to make him a good guy. A good Mason, and we tried to portray, like I say, baseline masonry, things that every Mason could understand and identify with, and maybe open that door. I'm like you. I have an esoteric, mystical side that just is such a big draw for me, and that's where my mind is. But I wanted people to have that idea and knowledge that there is something more, and that they can pursue more if they want to, and to enjoy reading it at the same time. I will tell you that to this day, many, many, many people believe that John Deacon is real. I get invitations for John and me to come and talk at their lodge, at some lodge someplace, and it always makes me smile that they do believe that, and it's kind of special that they do, but he is fictitious, but I guess in a way he is kind of real.
Oh, man. I don't know what it is. Like, all of a sudden, I just got, like, the warm fuzzies like we were talking about, you know, the lodge over Simpkins store or something. But
yes, absolutely.
You know, this was so cool. So with these books, I mean, you wrote four of them. How long does each one take? How long did you work on them? I mean, obviously, there was enough to fill up four volumes. And, you know, as a follow-up, what are you thinking about for the future? Are we going to continue this series?
Well, I probably had the best of four of all worlds. I will tell you that from a practical point of view, I'm not a writer. You know, I'm just someone who basically the movie, so to speak, starts playing in my head, and I just type till the movie's over. And he tried to tell the story. Most all of the stories are something that has happened to me or has happened to a brother that I know or has happened in lodge that I wove the story around it. But I wrote an article every month in our lodge for over 10 years. And so it turned out to be, got in the neighborhood of 96 articles. And they were already written. And guys were telling me, "You've got to put these in a book." I had a brother from Australia who was just a major John Deacon fanatic. And he, you know, the Texas part of it was always a thing that played in. And he was all interested in that. And he's actually the one that coined the term that it was a new form of Carl Claudy's, you know, Tyler Talks, the old Tyler Talks, and he was a big fan of it, and because all those articles were already out there, I met a brother who was starting a publishing company, and he asked me, he says, "Can you send them to me, and would you allow me to publish them?" And I did, and there were so many of them that it kind of had to be four books, and And the answer to your follow-up question, there's not a day goes by that somebody doesn't say, hey, we need another, but we need a volume five. So, yes, at some point there will probably be about volume five, but right now, my fifth book is actually going to come out. I wrote an article about 15 years ago that the title of it was There Is No Texas Without Freemasonry. And there's a backstory to that. And I'd been coerced into including that into a book with a collection of all the writings that I've done over the past 20 years. And they want to publish that. So that'll be coming out at some point. And that's not a John Deacon book. It's a pretty much a Chris Williams book. but yes. Volume 5 of John Deacon will at some point come out because I've got so many people yelling at me to do it. So I'm going to do it. And you know as well as I do, you know, Masonic books, there's a lot of them out there, and nobody's going to get rich selling Masonic books, but just the warm and fuzzy, as you put it a while ago, of having it out there and people calling me and telling me how much they loved it, and it's just, there's really no feeling like it, to be honest with you. And one of the biggest, to me, things that came out of the book that was so neat is I've had so many women who have read the book. Their husbands have bought the books, and they've read the books. And, you know, they've called me and said, you know, I learned more about masonry reading about John Deacon than my husband ever told me, you know, in all the years of being a Mason. And I think that's pretty special.
That is awesome. You know, we don't have many books out there that I think in that way anyway that, I don't know, capture the imagination of some of our significant others and really looking at and learning something about the fraternity. That's really cool. I have to say, when you said and you mentioned Bonanza, I immediately thought about Haas. So I used to watch Bonanza. And I'm 40. And when I was growing up, I was with my grandma, my Nana, all the time, right? So every afternoon we watched Bonanza, and it was a thing, man. And I loved watching that with her. So when you said that, it just totally clicked for me. Isn't it kind of like an amalgamation of all of these different super Masons, right? That we've known over time, and that's really
absolutely
cool.
You know, all the guys that put those little seeds in us morally, spiritually, just the good over the bad and all that. And that's what I wanted John to be.
As you were talking, I realized that I didn't hit the check, like go button. And so I have all four of those books coming to me by Thursday. So I'm really excited to dig into them. I'm actually going to be going on a trip to Colorado this weekend, just a quick overnight. I have plenty of reading material to take me through the trip. So it's really cool.
Oh, I appreciate it. I sure hope you like it.
Oh, I know I will. I wanted to ask you, so you did mention this book about, you know, There Is No Texas Without Freemasonry. If I could pick your brain about that a little bit,
sure.
I'd love to. You know, it's no secret that Texas is a huge force in Freemasonry, tons of lodges. I think you all have more allied Masonic degree councils than any other state. You've got the biggest aprons, you've got all this great stuff coming out of Texas Masonry. And, you know, the history in Texas as well is really incredible. We're talking about, Texas Masons, in particular, the public school system, all kinds of really great things that have come out of Texas Masonry. And, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about your thoughts on Texas Freemasonry and what Freemasonry did for the state of Texas.
Well, the way that the paper came about is I had a brother call me up and say, hey, would you be our keynote speaker for five lodges in our district that we're having 50-year celebration or something like that, and would you please come and speak? And I said, I'd love to. What kind of talk do you want? And he said, man, I'd really like to have something about the history of Texas and how Freemasonry fit into it. And I said, I'd love to do that. I said, that's one of my big interests. And he said, great. He says, well, it's going to be on such and such a date, and I'm going to start advertising. Oh, by the way, what's the title going to be? And I said, wait a minute. You just asked me to do it 2 minutes ago, and now you want me to come up with a title. And he goes, well, I need it for advertising, and I thought for a second, and it just popped into my head. I said, what about there is no Texas without Freemason? And he goes, oh, my God, that's great, and he hung up. And so there I was with the phone to my ear, knowing that I had to come up with a paper to match that title. And so I spent about a month and a half on it, and it came out really good. And since it came out, I've probably presented that paper at 15 or 20 different places all around Texas. And as you know, Texas is a big state. So I've done some driving over the years to give that. The premise is that there were no Masonic lodges in Texas that were started in Texas, back in the area of, Texas and Mexico were at odds with each other before the Texas Revolution. All the lodges came out of Louisiana. Most all of them came out of Louisiana. And then, but there was a great need. There was quite a few Masons in Texas, but there were no lodges, and there was a great need to form a lodge in Texas. And it's kind of cool that five Masons got together and decided they wanted to form a lodge. They got together in secret in a grove of trees on a certain Mason's property in private, and they petitioned the Grand Lodge of Louisiana for a charter, which he granted, and they sent the charter to Anson Jones, who had it in his saddlebags the day before the Battle of San Jacinto, which defeated Santa Ana and sent him, you know, and ultimately ended that war. And it was in his saddlebags during the battle as he was participating in the battle. And after the battle, it was presented to the members of the lodge. So as far as we can find out, it's the only Masonic charter that was ever carried into battle before it was presented to the members of the lodge. And it's kind of a cool little part of the whole thing. But of the story of the independence, the fight for independence from Mexico by Texas, if you overlay it over the fight for the independence of the United States of America from England, they're almost identical in the way they all worked out and the way it happened. 85% of all of the city, county, state officials, politicians, people who started the state, were Masons. And in fact, in the 1800s, when all this came about, if you weren't a member of a Masonic lodge, you had a very little, very small chance of being elected to a public office in Texas. And all this is documented. It's all, you know, it's all true. And, of course, the first vice presidents of the state of Texas and vice presidents were all Masons. Mirabeau B. Lamar, you mentioned education. Mirabeau B. Lamar was the first vice president and the second president of the state of Texas. And, of course, his big thing was to create a Texas public school system. And, of course, the Masonic organization provided schoolhouses and paid teachers, and were a big force in that whole Texas educational, free educational school system. And to this day, we're involved in it in a lot of different programs and stuff. So 15% of all of the men who led the revolution and fight against Mexico were Masons. There's a plaque on the side of the Alamo that lists all the Masons that died at the Alamo. Among them was Juan Seguin, Davy Crockett, William Barrett Travis, Jim Bowie, Almiron Dickinson, and the list goes on. And it's real warm and fuzzy to all Texans to hear that story. And I really was fortunate to be able to write it. So that's the keynote story in the beginning of the book of all my writings and stuff.
That is so fantastic. You know, you use the term again, you know, the warm and fuzzies. And I think that's like kind of this idea that is really interesting today. We've got, well, it's hard to really talk about this in a way that is not political. And I don't mean this to be political, but I have to say, we have a nation right now that is divided, that Masonry could possibly provide an influence in the way we hold ourselves up, the way we show our civility, even amongst different opinions and brothers and lodges. And one of the things that I think we all kind of celebrate as Masons a lot of times is there's a real difference, I think, between a huge difference between what we would call like nationalism, which, you know, in recent times has been considered, you know, a negative, versus patriotism, which I think most Masonic lodges here in America strongly feel. They believe in not this kind of rose-colored glasses of America of yesteryear, but of the American dream, the American way of life, the freedoms we all stand for, almost is in kind of a thing to always strive for. Like, we've never quite made it, right? The unfinished pyramid kind of ideas. And when we talk about these historical, just awesome stories that give us feelings of good and patriotism and the ability for Freemasonry to come out and be such a force for good, you know, going from the early days and settlements of across America, even to something that I'm very passionate about, which is Masonry's involvement in the public school system, you know, regardless of states. I mean, of course, Texas, when you cannot talk about the school system and Masonry's involvement without Texas. And I think it's just so important to be able to call those things out. I've been guilty. I say guilty, like that implies some sort of a negative connotation there. But, you know, certainly I've been guilty of telling brothers like, hey, go to the local school board meetings. See what the school board needs for funding. Check out the liberal arts and tell them, I'm so-and-so from whatever lodge, and my lodge wants to supplement the whatever you need to bring back handwriting or a painting program or a language arts program, something, you know? I mean, we've always been there, and just because politicians touch things doesn't mean Masons can't assist, you know, the needy, which we've always been there for. So this is incredible. I'm really looking forward to this next book. I know I'm putting you on the spot. What do you think in terms of timeline? Are we looking at within the next year or so?
Well, I in turn, if my publisher ends up reading this, I'm putting him on the spot because I want to get it done and get it over with. And you touched on something about you can't talk about the influence of Freemasonry in the organization of Texas without talking about Freemasonry and the organization of the United States of America. And in that talk, there is no Texas without Freemasonry. There is a part of it that talks about the formation of the United States and how the Masons were involved in that and how it overlays what we did here in Texas. And that, to me, is one of the neatest parts of that talk, because it really puts everything into perspective. And you talked about Masons and politics and everything, and Masons have never been excluded or discouraged from being in politics. Masons need to be in politics because our principles and teachings and our moral lessons are badly needed in that venue. What we don't do is we don't sit there and talk and argue about politics and religion and stuff in lodge. And there's a reason for that. And when you think about it, there's no more perfect organization or movement ever than Freemasonry. If we could influence more people to follow Masonic teachings, we'd have less problems everywhere in the world. And that's, I know that's a general statement, but it's absolutely true.
I couldn't agree with you more. There's a ritual that it's not ritual, right? But there's a ceremony that was published by the George Washington National Masonic Memorial, and it's a birthday celebration for George Washington. If a lodge chooses to do it. My mother lodge, we used to do it, and you know, there's three memorized parts, you know, for the master and wardens to do, and the secretary, so forth. And it rehearses the role of George Washington. But something in that presentation really always sticks out to me, and it talks about our nation as a Masonic nation that has set a precedence for other countries not for other countries, but that so many other countries have attempted to emulate. And talking about our industry, our fidelity, and our character as Freemasons in the United States. And if we could capture that, you know, if we could capture that and teach people, I think, you know, more guys coming into Masonry, and I think there are, and learning through whatever means possible, certainly through allegory and story, as we love to learn, then they can go out into their communities and families and really exemplify these virtues and hopefully set their own precedent for other people to try to emulate.
That is so well said. I'm one of the old guys, you know, and I'm approaching 70 years old, and so I'm considered one of the old mossback Masons, but I have a real optimism. You are the same age as my son, by the way, and I have a real optimism that what you just said is true, and that the brothers that are coming into Masonry right now, I am so optimistic that they are, and I can see that they are looking for the things that we're talking about. I mean, they're looking to accomplish, to learn and become knowledgeable and to emulate everything that Masonry is supposed to be for all of us. And I really believe that this is going to be a great time for our fraternity. And I'm hopeful that we can make the difference that Masonry was intended to make.
Absolutely. Let me ask about these books a little bit more. When we look at the four books, out of all of the stories that you've written, I'm curious, is there one that stands out in particular that when it came to you, you just couldn't wait to get it down on paper? And as a follow-up to that, is there one that people constantly come back to you and say was their favorite?
You know, I think when you say, was there one that I couldn't wait to get on paper, when something happened wherever I was, I would even have brothers look at me and go, there's your story, you know, because they knew what I was trying to do with this whole thing. And, yeah, there was many of them that I just couldn't wait to get out on paper, and I couldn't stop writing the whole thing. And the message that came out of it was just, you know, mind-blowing for me. I will tell you from a personal standpoint, a personal favorite, try to make this short. I get accused of inventing the wheel every time I tell a story, but my grandfather, like I said, died at 6 years old, and when I finally became a Mason, I became master of my lodge, and I decided I wanted to get to know my grandfather, and I know you've heard this many times. Brothers that will hear this will nod when I'm saying this, that you didn't really know that relative in real life, but because he was a Mason and you went and found out about his Masonic background and learned about him, all of a sudden you got to know him really well. And that happened to me. I visited his lodge. I looked at minutes that he had signed, you know, in 1942 and 1943. You'll hear my voice crack a little bit because I get pretty emotional about stuff like this, but I never knew where my grandfather's Masonic ring went. I never even thought about it, never even asked. My mother didn't know. But after touching base with my grandfather's lodge and visiting, about a year later, the secretary called me and in an email said, what would you say if I told you I knew where your grandfather's ring was? And after picking myself up off the floor, I told him, I don't have the words. And he told me a story that the worshipful master of his lodge and worshipful master's wife, who was very involved in Eastern Star, out of the clear blue one day after a Masonic meeting, turned to her husband and said, John, did you ever know Blaine Price? And that was the name of my grandfather. The secretary rushed her and says, where did that come from? You know, come up with that. And she smiled and she says, I don't know. I was standing right here and all of a sudden it kind of popped into my mind. And they all three turned at the same time and looked at the North Station. And above that North Station was my grandfather's Masonic picture for being master of the lodge. And he says, well, why did you ask him? And he says, well, when Blaine Price died, he was the best friend of my father. My father was master of the lodge, and he was his mentor. And his widow gave my father his Masonic ring, and I still have it. And he communicated that to me. They met me at Grand Lodge, and they presented me with my dad, my grandfather's Masonic ring, which I wear every day to this day. And he told me, and his words were absolutely fabulous, that he believed that my grandfather picked the right time, the right place, with the right people in place to get me his Masonic ring. And it is one of my favorite stories, and I wove that into a Masonic story in the John Deacon books, where John was me, and he told the story, and not a month goes by, I don't get somebody calling me and telling me what a great story that was. But there are many, many, many who are my favorites. And I've put a lot of my Masonic brothers in there and family and stuff. And it's just, I loved every minute of writing those stories. And I'm glad they're out there.
This has been just so awesome. And my heart got, you know, it was the Grinch, right? My heart got two sizes too big here in this story. This was how touching. I would have choked up myself talking about a story like that. Just incredible. And the thought and feeling that you put into your writing is obvious. I have to thank you for doing the work and putting these things together and the writing. And it's no small task to write a book. I mean, I've annotated books, I wrote one, and I've republished older texts, and it is no small task, especially when you know you have to do it. All of a sudden, the fun goes away sometimes. But hopefully, this creative spirit that you've unleashed and your imagination and pulling all these things together to continue bringing Masonic education to brothers and anybody interested, really, in these stories and in what they can teach us, I sure hope they find them, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure guys find these books.
Well, I sure appreciate it. And you know, you brought up a good point. I said earlier that I don't consider myself a writer. I don't have eloquent prose to put down. In fact, there was a famous author who was trying to disparage another author, you know, kind of getting under his skin. And he made the statement one time that there's not a word in the book that you'll have to go to the dictionary to find the meaning. And that's pretty much the way it is in my books. You know, John Deacon is he's not an eloquent man. He's not even a college educated man, but he knew what he wanted to say, and he knew how to say it. And it's just really basic, and a lot of people identify with that. And for that, I'm grateful, and I'm grateful to all of my Masonic brothers who pushed me for 15 years to finally get them published. And it's a good feeling, I'll tell you that.
You know, it is frustrating at times to certainly read texts that are so airy and lofty and sometimes beautiful and poetic, but let's face it, you know, I grew up in the 90s and I used to watch Dennis Miller Live, and I would have to have a thesaurus, have to have a thesaurus next to me half the time because, you know, the words that guy used were so intense. And so I certainly appreciate a read that is, I'm not going to say easy, but one that is, you know, contemporarily written in a way that we can all understand and be there in plain language. And I think brothers will appreciate that too.
I am extremely grateful for you giving me this opportunity. It really is. I appreciate it.
The opportunity is mine, my brother. This was so cool to be able to talk with you. Well, this is coming to the end here, but Brother Chris, again, I have to thank you for coming on the program, sharing your story, sharing a little bit about these books and future projects. Of course, everyone out there who's listening, we're going to put the links to these books in the show notes. And of course, you'll find them all over social media also. I'm going to dig into them as soon as they get to my house on Thursday. I got all four volumes coming. And let me tell you, you guys can pick up these four books for a very reasonable cost. I think it was about $50 delivered prime for all four books, which If you're like me, sometimes you spend $50 on one book. Anybody out there, this is a great value, some really cool stuff. So, Brother Chris, thank you so much for taking the time with me. And I know we had to reschedule a few times, but I really appreciate you making it.
Well, I am so grateful that you got through this rescheduling thing. I apologize for all of that, but this was fabulous. And Brother Robert, I am truly grateful to talk to you. And I'm actually going to send you an email, There Is No Texas Without Freemasonry, the actual article, the actual paper, so you can read it.
Wonderful. I can't wait. All right. One more time, I want to give a shout out and a thank you to Brother Chris Williams for all of his hard work putting these books together. Links to those books will be in the show notes, as well as on our bookstore portion of the website. So you'll be able to find them whenever you want in case it's been a few weeks and you don't feel like scrolling through the episode backlog to find the links. They'll all be there. To wrap things up this week, I wanted to go ahead and do a tarot card reflection draw. For many out there who listen to this, then you know what we're doing. However, if this is your first time, then what I want to tell you is we're not using the tarot in any kind of divinatory way. We are taking the prescribed meanings of the cards, using them as is, and looking at what that can tell us about our current state. Not that we're going to be telling the future, but rather think of it more of a Rorschach. Somebody shows you an ink blot, you tell me what you see. Then we talk about why you see that. So in this, there are images and prescribed meanings to the cards. We can take those prescribed meanings and say, is anything in your life related to this? And if so, let's address it. So today I'm going to be using the Robin Wood Tarot. It's created by Robin Wood. I'll have the link to purchase the deck in the show notes if you're interested. It's a standard 2-inch by 4.75-inch deck of cards. Give them a quick shuffle here. Again, no specific way that I shuffle. Shuffling for me and keeping a positive mindset, I think, about the cards allows me to sort of cleanse the deck, if you want to talk about it that way. Cleanse your thinking about, you know, any preconceived notions that you might have in your head when you draw the card. So, we'll go ahead and draw the card. All right. I got a Three of Cups, but I also had the card inverted. So let's talk about the Three of Cups. Now, the Three of Cups usually has three women on it holding the cups. They might be hanging out. Looks like they're partying a little bit. You know, for anybody who is in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group, I'll take a picture of the card so you can take a look at that and contemplate on the imagery. The three ladies usually have, like, again, look like they're partying or at least celebrating something. Now, cups in and of itself is a real feminine card. It's about vessels. It's a cup. It's a thing that holds things. Sometimes, like, a Two of Cups might indicate a mixing of the waters, pregnancy, birth kind of thing. But in this case, you've got three women, three cups. So this is like kind of double feminine, but it's also inversed. So what does it mean? Well, according to the Robin Wood Tarot, in its inversed fashion, they say that it represents gluttony, overindulgence, delay. Talents are hidden or unappreciated. Abundance turns to lack and pleasure to pain. So it's kind of a bummer card. And I'm not going to focus on that too much because I use traditional kind of practical meanings behind the cards. Not that I'm making anything up, right? But let's look at it through the lens of practicality. Now, the Three of Cups reversed, and you know, if you know me, then I don't focus on negative aspects of tarot, because I don't think that's really even appropriate. So, the card means, in its upright position, this idea of three people coming together. It could be friendship, coming together for a small party. The thing I love about the upright card of Three of Cups really means collaboration. And so, the opposite of collaboration might mean that, you know, three is too many people. Could mean you are, I mean, if you really want to look at this in a very practical, kind of basic way, it means maybe you're getting together having too many drinks too often, right? I mean, what could that be? It also could mean that it's time, instead of having three people around you or collaborating, it's time to work independently. It's time for some alone time. Now, to take it further, I just would ask, within the things that you're doing in your life, maybe even in Freemasonry, is there something that you're trying to get done and it really seems like it's just time to get it done? You're going to do it by yourself. You know, if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself, right? And this is this idea that maybe because you have the specific vision for something and you lack the ability to properly communicate it, or perhaps it's just easier to do on your own, that it's time to do that. This is your affirmation that, yeah, go ahead, get it done. If there is a negative side to this card, then it might just mean that there's this thing that Brother John Ruark says sometimes, FOMO, which is fear of missing out. Maybe this means that you've got a fear of missing out, that you're on the outside of the circle of friends, or that you're missing out on something that's happening in a social scene that is something that does happen. Think about it Masonically. Are there officer meetings that are happening that maybe you're not a part of? And why are you not a part of them? Is it because you hold a bias, because you hold a sway, that maybe perhaps we should not be a part of something, right? This is what we have, and sometimes we have to recuse ourselves from certain committees and tasks because we have too much kind of skin in the game, as it were, that we might color the outcome based on what we want, no matter how much we try to stay out of it. Being a past master myself and somebody who does a podcast and knows quite a bit about Freemasonry, I find it much of the time something that I need to do is to remove myself from conversations happening with lodges, because the last thing I want to do is color a lodge in what I would consider, you know, the perfect sense of what I think is the right thing to do. Now, when I talked about that overly practical, really basic thing of overindulgence, yeah, you know, maybe if we're doing too much partying or drugs or drinking heavily, we should help to remember. It would do us well to remember equilibrium in all things. Now, this version of the card is interesting because this particular card in the Robin Wood deck does not necessarily have the same type of universal symbolism that other cards have. Usually the three women have, two of them have opposite looking dresses and one of them is wearing a mixture of the two kind of dresses. So there's some additional symbolism going on there. I hope that gives you some good insights into possibly what it could mean. Again, I'll take a picture of this card in this particular deck and I will upload it to the Craftsman Plus Facebook group for you to check out. Now, one more time, I want to give one last shout-out to our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners for making the show possible. If you're curious on how to assist the WCY Podcast in bringing Masonic light to those interested, please head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show and check out the different options we have available. Until next week, stay on the level for Whence Came You. I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.